This is Dissecting Dragons, the speculative fiction podcast for writers and readers by writers and readers.
Hello, and welcome to Dissecting Dragons, the speculative fiction podcast for writers and readers by writers and readers. I'm Madeleine Vaughan.
And I'm Jules Ironside. This week, Old Gods and the Ancient Stones, what folk horror has to teach a modern audience. And this week, we're really delighted to introduce Phil Breach, who is a weird fiction, dark fantasy, and sort of nature, sort of horror poet. Is that right, Phil?
Yeah, I think that basically covers it. Yeah, mythic, dark myth, and all that kind of stuff. Yeah, but weird fiction, folk horror, nature, yeah.
All the things that you want on a Samhain Eve.
Absolutely. And so he's joining us for this episode on folk horror. This is hopefully not going to sound offensive, but I kind of think folk horror, and at some point down on my mental list of things that I put in folk horror category, you kind of pop up there with particularly some of your poems, and I'm not entirely sure why that is, but possibly because you've got such a strong resonance with nature, and there seems to be quite a pagan flavour to some of it as well, because of the old god connections.
Yeah, I mean, it, to a degree, that does express my own beliefs as well. You know, I'm pagan, really. You know, kind of a weird kind of mixture of all different things, but I don't entirely. You know, it's not entirely fiction. The stuff I write. My kind of spiritual meaning is nature and fae and darkness.
Yeah, you're in good company here with that, to be quite honest.
Yeah, I thought I might.
Excellent company. I'd like to point out that I was not the one who brought up the F word this time, so there you go.
Oh, the fae, does that often come up?
It comes up so often that we have what is known as the fairy jar, whereby if I bring up fairy, I have to put a coin in the fairy jar. At this point, I could put myself through university again, the amount of times I talk about fairies. So I'm just pointing out that I don't need to put a coin in this week because I was not the one who brought it up. So there you go.
I'll add a few. Yeah, no, I'm sure I will by the end of it.
If anyone follows Phil on Instagram or Facebook, I don't know if you're on Twitter actually,
I'm not on Twitter, or
Facebook, he does these most beautiful sort of nature pictures, and you've got a real feel for capturing sort of landscape. And I don't know, I wander around and I walk for miles every day, and I always forget to take a picture. I've got my phone with me, but I always forget to take pictures.
I'm quite lucky because in my day job, I'm an archaeologist, and I'm out in the field all day, you know, out digging, basically.
Yeah.
And not always in nice places, but quite a lot of the time, I'm in somewhere beautiful. So, you know, a lull, you know, tea break or whatever, or end of the job, I'll wander around, take a few photos. So it's quite nice in that way. And, yeah, and obviously, I'm out walking about in my own time. So. But yeah, that adds to the store of photos, and I'm always outside.
I can really see how your profession would sort of bleed into your creativity. As an archaeologist, I mean, that's ideal, right, for sort of folk horror and the old stories and the, you know, that just sounds perfect.
It is, yeah. Digging up very, very old, because it's particularly prehistory is my favourite thing. I dig up everything. You dig up what we're told to dig, but you know, when it's some really old stuff, something particularly evocative about that. Not knowing what it is part of the fun for me, the mystery of it all.
That's brilliant. That's fantastic. Before we get started, we're actually going to be treating all of our listeners to something a little bit different, and we're going to ask Phil if he would please read us one of his poems.
Okay, this one I wrote quite recently is called Samhain Sonnet. 'Tis the very crack of winter, Samhain. Our presence is required at the stones, to mourn the mighty dead, and dance and grieve, and to slather oakered tallow on their bones. Then it's time for them to come, the hallow hops, up from Mother Earth to show the way, mingling midst the keening and the salts, to lead us to the chalk above the clay. On the corpse road up to Barrow Field we'll go, to take the red and fatted dead back home, through the thinning veil to lay them low, and beg them not to rise and rave and run. The mighty dead will heave and haul and drag, and leave them in the keeping of the hag.
Thank you.
That was fantastic.
Yeah, it's so atmospheric, and it's the capturing of a time that sort of obviously isn't our own.
And yet, for a moment there, it was, you know. That was fantastic. I love it. This is, ooh, it's the spooky season, and I'm so thrilled.
It's basically your favourite time of year, isn't it, Madeline?
Yeah, I really do like this time of year, because I love Christmas as well, so just this whole lead-up, it's fantastic. I just get so excited. The whole thing. Big tick from me. Okay, so having had that very atmospheric entrance to the subject, let's talk a little bit about folk horror, starting with that rather key question of, what is it?
Well, it's quite a difficult one to define in some ways. I mean, we talked about ghost stories recently and what goes into them and what really doesn't go into them. A literal definition of folk horror is, it's a genre which deals with the dark side of folklore, and by extension, the darker side of humanity. So where with a ghost story, you're using the ghost to reflect something within your main character, your individual, something unresolved within themselves. Folk horror kind of reflects something like buried injustice or something that's wrong at a community level. So it's kind of on a larger scale, but there's also a very strong connection with the land as well. And it's a term that's comparatively recent. I don't think the term actually got coined until sort of about 2012, but it actually, you know, it, as a genre, it's existed for much longer than that. There's what they call the unholy trinity of films from the 70s, for example, which include things like The Witchfinder General, Blood on Satan's Claw, and The Wicker Man, obviously.
I was going to say The Wicker Man. That always comes to mind when I think of folk horror.
Yeah, and obviously they're looking at, well, I mean, obviously we'll go into it a bit more, but it, as a genre, it doesn't have very many rigid parameters, and it sort of relies on this feel of a certain something. And it also doesn't really have to take part out in, I guess, out in the rural areas, because you can have urban folk horror, which is usually kind of a liminal thing where, you know, nature is butting up against the sprawling urbanisation as we build on it. So it's a really interesting genre.
I really do like it though, because it's like the opposite of the rural fantasy, which of course kind of really spurted up in the Victorian era, where it was this whole, oh, look at that, isn't that wonderful? And then sort of folk horror is that, no, let's actually talk about what things are really like. And again, it doesn't necessarily have to be in a rural location, as you say, but it's talking about that undercurrent which for so long literature kind of just put as this ideal world, and saying, no, it's not ideal, and we're going to use horror in order to explore how horrifying some of these conditions and some of people's lives were.
And it also, I think there's folk horror very, very much about one of the motifs, whether it be urban or rural, particularly it works particularly well for rural, though, is the outsider. There's a, you know, generally there's someone who doesn't know the rules, comes to a bad end, or at least, you know, fearful things happen because they don't know. But I mean, I'm thinking so many examples. But I think, have you seen Midsommar?
No, not yet. I've got a rough idea what happens, but you're absolutely right. It's a case of folk horror is not at all forgiving of the person who blunders in all ignorant and...
No, exactly, yeah. They don't know the rules, and They don't have, it's that otherness, the otherness of the outsider and the otherness of what they encounter.
Yeah, but they tend to come again with this very idealised sense of what it's going to be like, which, again, for anyone who's ever lived or worked in a rural community, my favourite thing ever is when you hear about people who are like, oh, I'd love to retire and just, you know, have a vineyard and stuff like that. And I'm like, do you have any idea how much work a vineyard is? Do you have, it's like, oh, you know, just have a little farm. Okay, do you have any idea actually yeah. how much work, you know, running a farm? And it's that, it's this whole sort of, this outsider who comes in like, oh, you know, the simplistic community, I know the rules, I could very easily follow this. And it's like, no, actually, you are an outsider, you are assuming things, you assume actually, usually there's this sense of the outsider kind of feeling like, well, I'm a bit superior, even if they don't vocalise that. They internalise it in the sense of course I can fit in, this is a lesser kind of society, it'll be easy for me to fit. And because they do that, they realise very quickly that they've missed something, that there is an intrinsic knowledge that they are not privy to, and that that will be fatal, usually.
Yeah, definitely. My parents live out, really out in the sticks in Dorset. On top of a hill in what would have been a farm worker's cottage. And, you know, it's not really working farm in terms of having cows anymore, or till up until recently it was. So it's just a very small sort of mixed farm now. And there are holiday cottages on the farm. And every year, not this year perhaps, but every other year when someone has hired the holiday cottages, there's always one or two who complain about the fact that the countryside smells, or the church bells from the nearby village, which is about 2.5 miles away, are too loud, or the birds wake them up in the morning, or isn't everything a long way away? What do you mean there's only one bus every 3.5 hours?
Classic folk horror victim.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm pretty sure they don't actually build wicker men around that area, at least in that area of Dorset.
It just makes me think of that, the holiday, which was that we've come on holiday by mistake.
Yes.
It does in a very comedic way, yes. Yeah.
I mean, that's folk horror elements, isn't it, really?
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah, there's that element, particularly when Jake, the poacher, comes down. He leaves him a hair, isn't he? But to start with, you know, there's definitely that element of, well.
See, the thing was, I watched that when I was a teenager, and I remember thinking, I don't understand why this is supposed to be so funny, because I know people like this. Is this genuinely satire, or what's going on? I mean, the other thing is, obviously, that we'll get on to why folk horror is important in a moment, but the other thing is that folk horror has sort of seeded itself through lots of different genres as well. So, I mean, it turns up a lot in crime. It turns up, obviously, hand in hand with the odd ghost story and various other things as well. And it's really interesting when you get films like last year's Overlord, which is set during the Second World War, and is kind of, it's more sci-fi horror in a way. But the fact that it's set in this small part of France, and you've got this very provincial feel, and yet you've got a secret Nazi base in the area, and they're doing experiments on people that kind of basically turn them into, like, like make them Hulk out kind of thing. And it's like, yeah, that's not folk horror. And yet you can kind of see that it's been peering over folk horror's fence, because it obviously lives next door.
Folk horror shaking its walking stick.
Pretty much, yeah.
I think the thing is that because folk horror, oh dear, sort of channeling a bit of Scooby-Doo there, folk horror is so linked with the environment, because the idea of the folk and the fae and a lot of these kind of mythical and sort of pagan sort of creatures which appear in folk horror are themselves born or representative of the elements. When you get a strong elemental presence in anything, even if it's not meant to be folk horror, you get the tone of folk horror. So set anything in the countryside, particularly, you know, rural Provençal France, you get that sense of the earth and the environment watching, and also that because there's a link with secretiveness when it comes to that sort of dark things being concealed by the earth or under the earth. I'm not surprised that, yeah, you might get a vibe from that, even if it's not actually supposed to be folk horror.
Yeah, definitely. And there's also, you think of older films as well, such as the film they made of Angela Carter. There's too many Angelas in this conversation already, apparently. Of In the Company of Wolves, which is a dark fairy tale retelling. And yet, again, that draws very strongly on folk horror-esque type themes, the way they've portrayed it.
The visuals in that film, particularly the transformation scenes, are harrowing.
I've loved that film since I was about 12 years old. Obviously, I shouldn't have been watching at 12, but, you know,
no.
I was a macabre little creature. And
there's another film you just reminded me of. I think it might have been done by the same, by Rick Baker, who did the special effects on that.
Yeah, I think so.
American Werewolf in London. And
do you know, that was also on my list of films to mention as being sort of influenced heavily by folk horror, and I completely agree.
Yeah. And that was the first horror film I ever saw. It absolutely terrified. I was 12. I was exactly the same age, 12, when I watched.
Yeah,
terrified. But definitely
see, my dad actually said, "Oh, do you want to watch this with American Werewolf?" And I was like, "Well, what is it? Oh, it's about, you know, it's got werewolves now." I'm like, "Oh, well, I'm so in then." And yeah, I think it was pretty scary when I was 12, and it's still a film that I'll go back to because I just love the way that it's been put together. It's something that really sort of respected the old werewolf lore from that area, and you know they're looking at the North Yorkshire moors, so they're probably looking at things like the Flixton werewolf, and it's just the more you sort of dig into it, the more interesting it all is.
And the Outsider thing, the beginning,
yeah,
the slaughtered lamb and all that, it's kind of yeah. Really, that writ large, the Outsider's coming into situations that I understand.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that's the thing with werewolf films, not to go off on too much of a tangent, but they are they're nearly all tragedies. A true werewolf film is like somebody who didn't know what they were doing ended up in a situation whereby they became the monster, whether they wanted to or not. And it's like this ultimate expression of nature has teeth and the mountain doesn't really care. And now you're the monster. And, you know, the only way out of it is for you to like hold on to your humanity long enough for someone else to kill you. So in classic werewolf folklore tradition, they are nearly all tragedies.
It's funny because at the moment I'm teaching the Gothic, which most of the listeners will know. And part of that is looking at The Woman in Black, which is listed as a ghost story. But the more I read it, the more I really get the sense that it feels more like folk horror to me. And I think one of the things that really highlighted that was someone actually pointed out the similarities between the beginning of The Woman in Black and Dracula as well.
Yeah.
And I mean, obviously the Gothic has that whole conversation about the environment and the past versus the future and all those kinds of things. So you get those themes coming through, and there is a relationship between the Gothic and folk horror. But the reason that really sticks out for me with The Woman in Black is the fact that the environment plays such a key part in creating that sense of isolation. And the woman herself seems like less of a ghost because she's not necessarily reflecting Kipps, the character. She's reflecting this complete wrath about a circumstance, which was a societal circumstance, whereby she was unable to raise her own child because society would not allow it. And as a subsequence of that, her child died. And so she has then turned her wrath against the whole of society and is killing them one by one. And she can't be stopped. She can't be reasoned with. So she's not reflecting the main character, she's reflecting this injustice. And it's, yeah, I think that that's really why I feel like it's folk horror. And it's possibly why The Woman in Black is probably the scariest, well, definitely the scariest play I've ever seen, but one of the scariest stories that I've ever encountered. It has affected me so profoundly.
Okay, so looking at why folk horror is important, because it does more than entertain, in my opinion. And, you know, if you look at things like, I don't know if either of you've read H is for Hawk by Helen MacDonald, where it's beautiful, but it, you know, she's processing loss and grieving through training her peregrine falcon. And you've got Robert McFarlane's Nature Writing, which again I really love, and I find it really restful to read as well.
And well, I've just read Underland, which just at times terrifying, and definitely, I think looking at the folk horror kind of theme, some of the, I don't know if you've read it, Underland, but some of the places go definitely reflect that kind of otherness that's sort of around or beneath the feet. When he goes into the Paris sort of catacombs. Oh, gosh. So, yeah, definitely there's that sense of it.
And they're very, they're definitely worth a visit.
You've been there, have you?
Any catacombs, actually. I've been to the catacombs in Paris. I've also been to the catacombs outside of Rome as well, which is, again, interesting experience.
I think the catacombs in Paris are particularly scary because sometimes you can go in and you might not come out.
They found, yeah, people have just never come. Yeah, he talked about it.
Yeah, just never.
Yeah, they just get lost. It's terrifying. Also, small caveat, but because of the way that the underground works in Paris, you can be up on the street level and the ground beneath you will shake, and that's the trains going underneath you, and it actually creates this terrible sense of just the whole ground beneath you being hollow. You don't know what's underneath you at any given time, and it kind of feels like you're sort of on an eggshell that separates you from hell. So that's a fun thing next time you're in Paris, which in itself might as well be a circle of hell as far as I'm concerned. But hey ho, back to folk horror.
Yeah, so looking at the sort of nature writing, and there's lots of them. I mean, there's Rain or Winds, The Salt Path as well, which was a really interesting book. There's something fundamentally unsatisfying as capitalism as a whole system for humans. And, you know, there are people who are genuinely trying to find some bigger connection to a rural past, if you like, and not from the perspective of, oh, well, cream comes out of the tap and it's a simpler way of life. And I think folk horror kind of builds on that idea. So, yes, it's fun to reminisce, but you've got to remember that wherever you go, there you are. So if you go somewhere thinking that that place is going to solve all your problems for you, you have to acknowledge the fact that most of your problems are probably within you, and you're taking them with you. And no amount of sort of bucolic vision of nostalgic, countrified past is actually going to help you there, because it's actually quite a dangerous lie to fall for.
Yeah, absolutely. Particularly also because it's just, as we say, it's that sense of going somewhere safe, you feel. And again, that sense of superiority, therefore, which is this society is safe. The people who live here have it easy. It's going to be easy for me to just step into this with no real acknowledgement of what lurks underneath, both societally but also in terms of the environment, and that the demons that you are trying to run from may be more powerful here.
Yeah. So, I mean, it's kind of looking a bit at your Celtic folklore, Celtic mythology, where, you know, they don't represent nature as just this soft, nurturing mother who is eternally forgiving of her children. There's also, you know, the sow devouring its own young, and the nastiest side of nature. And it is an eternal balance. And I think folk horror does something to redress that balance. And it, you know, at its base level, it kind of makes you take a long, hard look at the misuse of community because one of the human race's big curses, as well as its big assets, is its chumminess. The fact that we will all band together, and then we tend to create little tribal them and us type mindsets.
Yeah. Absolutely. Okay. So, let's have a look at some of the folk horror themes and tropes that you can expect to find. The first one that comes to mind, which I've already mentioned in terms of the woman in black, is obviously isolation.
Yeah, definitely. And obviously that was something you brought up as well, wasn't it, Phil, at the beginning?
Yeah. That sort of, isolation, the outsider coming in, finding themselves, no one to turn to except more people, more secret, and they don't.
Yeah, I mean, hell, Jules, you brought it up just in terms of the, we're here, why is everything so far away? Because you're in the middle of the countryside, you came here because you wanted to be far away from everything, you cannot therefore be surprised that you are literally far away from everything. But of course, it's not just physical isolation we're talking about, we're also talking about the emotional isolation, which, Phil, obviously, you went into detail with, in terms of being isolated from a community, isolated from some kind of knowledge that the community all know and share, but which you are, the information is not extended to you.
Yeah, that's it. Books explaining like straw dogs when it comes to my good. But another one that I think of, you mentioned crime earlier, books by Phil Ritten.
Ah, yes, he's one of my favourite authors. I've been trying not to say, because I bring him up a lot, and I get to the point where I think Madeline thinks I'm trying to indoctrinate her or something.
Put a coin in the Phil Ritten jar.
But
I mean, he in so many books, that sense of otherness, that sense of an outsider coming. I mean, his most famous series, really, what? I mean, she's the classic outsider coming and becoming an insider, but in a wonderful way. Oh, Madeline, you really should read it. But even before,
thanks,
even
Bill.
Before Mary, you know, all of his stories have that kind of theme going through. Right?
Yeah, definitely. The Chalice and The Man in the Moss and Candle Night. And so, I've been a big fan of his since I was about sort of 14, 15, I think. And whenever there's a new Merrily Watkins book out, I'm always very, very excited.
I must confess, I've fallen behind a bit, but I need to catch up with him. But there's no one writes. I could go off on a tangent about Phil Ritten. No one writes dialogue like Phil Ritten. I mean, he's brilliant.
Yeah.
He's brilliant. But he really, he's really, over the course of the Merrily Watkins novel, he explores the themes of isolation, of madness, and always with the, you know, yes, there is always usually some supernatural element, but they're always kind of flickering around the edges, aren't they? It's very rarely front and centre.
Yeah.
Which makes it all the more, all the more disconcerting to read and to encounter. It's this sort of, you're not quite sure what you're looking at. You're not quite sure what's doing that or what's around the corner.
I met him a couple of years ago when he did an author event at one of the libraries, and he and Andrew Taylor were there. And it was Samhain again, and it was the 31st, and we were sat in a dark library with a couple of candles, and everyone had wine, and we were just sort of talking about it, and they were talking about their books, and Phil said, you know, yes, his books are filed under crime, and that's where they probably should go, but in his head he kind of writes ghost stories and he writes folk horror, even though there's a strong crime component, because largely that's kind of what makes them sell. And I thought that was very interesting. And it was him talking about sort of the folk horror elements he encounters. And it's one of the things was, you know, he sort of lives off towards the other side of the Cotswold Way, and the library I work in is on the Cotswold Way. And so you encounter a lot of people with these very specific mindsets. Like, you get people in from the Welsh border and they very definitely have the mindset as he's kind of reflected them. And he said, you know, I'm fascinated by ghost stories. I'm fascinated by local legends and things. But the thing that always horrifies him is when you accidentally stray into territory where you're clearly not welcome conversationally, and this sort of wall comes down. And people just stop talking to you. And he said, and, you know, I've encountered it a few times, and it is very, very worrying when that happens, because there could be absolutely anything going on behind that.
Mm.
And he does have some pretty dark things go on.
He really does, yeah. So the other thing Phil does, going on to another of the themes or tropes that we find in folk horror, is landscape. He really makes the landscape feel like it's a character in its own right, and it explores our relationship with land as well.
Definitely.
And that is something that folk horror definitely does.
It's explored a lot in I don't know if you're familiar with, listeners familiar with the Facebook group Folk Horror Revival. Which is, I thoroughly recommend you join.
No.
It's a big group now. I'm one of the admins of the group, so I've been doing it for a while. But it's definitely worth checking out. And in all of these, you know, because it's a Facebook group, lots of photos, there's an awful lot of wonderful, evocative photography goes on there. Places, you know, wonderful, dark, eerie places. But yeah, I just, as an aside, I would say get yourself into Folk Horror Revival. It's a great group, and it takes it. You know, folk horror is such a wide remit. There's so much that can fit into it, as you said at the beginning. You know, all the elements of folklore and folk tales, which often do involve obviously the landscape, they're all part of the mix. And it hasn't necessarily got to be horrific. This is one thing that we try and point out in the group. Is that, I mean, it's usually dark, because most folklore is dark. There's very little happy stuff. I mean, because folk tales are just, you know, saccharine. You know, they wouldn't have lasted that long. It's normally something really, you know, it's told in several ways, where the woman's rushing off from her cottage to go to the village, and she leaves her baby, and she either sees the devil or the wild hunt or a raven, and says, you know, she goes off and they go, she says, where are you going? The raven or the devil or whatever says, you know, I'm going to whatever her village is, and when she gets back, the baby's gone, they find the bones, and it's always this kind of, you know, darkness, the darkness of it.
Yeah, it's never a particularly happy ending, is it?
Yeah, there's rarely a happy ending in folk tales, folklore. It's generally there's generally a dark end to someone or something. So, yeah, so even though it's horror, I think, you know, and obviously things like The Wicker Man, the film Ritual, and all that, you know, out and out horror, but I think just the general tropes of folklore are dark enough to enfold it within the folk horror.
Okay, another thing that we do find in folk horror is skewed or alternate moral beliefs. This one always fascinates me, because obviously we start with our standard, our outsider coming in, perhaps hoping to find escape from something they're running from, or healing from something that happened to them, and they're woefully ignorant, which makes them vulnerable. And the skewed or alternate moral belief is that sense that everybody else is in the know and you're not, and yet they might actually be acting on it in a way that would be considered reprehensible. And yet if you then flip that, if you happen to be one of the people who's always been on the inside and always knew how things worked, and this is how things work, and this is why we keep these traditions going, then the outsider would be the unwelcome one and the one with the weird moral beliefs. So I always find that quite an interesting mirror to look into.
Yeah.
I think another thing I like about folk horror in that is that because the newcomer is stumbling into something often ancient, they very rarely, more often than not, they don't manage to overturn the old ways. You know, like for instance, you know, yeah. Wicker Man, he ends up, you know, and also, if you haven't seen it, but Midsummer is the same. You know, there isn't like, and then if he manages to, or she manages to, you know, to kill the whatever, kill the boss, and kill the headman of the village, or bring the people in, you know, and bring the outside in. The outside stays out, and the person meets their end, and no one will know about it. That's part of what I like about it, really. You don't always want I often find myself rooting for the so-called bad, you know, and it's quite satisfying when you have kind of a type of story where it carries on, the ancientness carries on the way it always has, and you're just seeing kind of a snapshot into one of the events that happened when that person happened to come to the village. They weren't the first, and they no doubt won't be the last. I like that kind of, I like that feeling.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think that perhaps the reason that it's satisfying to us to watch that, despite, even if we are sort of rooting for the people, is that, once again, at the heart of folk horror lies that question of the environment and, you know, something larger than humanity. And the whole idea is that because it usually comes from a character who's stepping away from the civilized world into the rural world, as it were, of course the supernatural element, the folk horror element, wins because it is more powerful, it is prevailing, and no matter what you try to do to ignore it or pretend that it doesn't exist or put up rules around it, it is the rule of nature, and it will prevail no matter what happens. And so in some ways it's almost comforting, if not also very frightening, that there is a power, there's a larger power that we just cannot escape, and that exists as a rule of life.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. It's I suppose it's kind of a reverse on that Bible verse from Genesis where, you know, God's giving Adam dominion over all creatures of the earth, and actually that's not really how it works. That was quite a neat bit of propaganda, but ultimately we owe respect to nature from whence we came. And again, nature isn't just about giving and providing and feeding us, it's also about, you know, taking us back at the end.
So. Yeah. Sorry, it's just nature stood there sort of tapping its watch like tick tock.
It's entropy time. All right, here's a thought for discussion. Folk horror is reflective of our most primordial instincts. So, sex, the hunt, and death.
You just ticked it. There we go. All right.
Yeah.
So, yes, next, moving on.
Yeah, that's it.
I think where we could go a bit further with that is the fact that when we're talking about isolation and skewed moral beliefs or skewed perspectives, because, you know, they've had a chance to grow in a different direction, shall we say, within a community, is that you make these primordial instincts, the things that about us that really haven't changed at all, the focus for building a community, rather than it works together if we all kind of, it's a different kind of, if we all pitch together, we get something that we want. And where we've all gone in a direction whereby it's not really a meritocracy, but we try to say it is, and the end game is kind of money rather than literally just making enough for you to shelter and eat, etc., and feed your family. This is very much about, no, we're going to intercede with the old gods and with nature itself. It's the time of year to sow the fields with blood kind of thing.
No way that ever goes wrong.
Is it the, I mean, I can't be mentioning the sex side of it. One thing that comes to mind, and so I never forgot,
yeah,
in the first of Bill Whitman's Mary Watkins, The Wine of Angels, when he encounters the idea of the first woman a young man sleeps with.
The Powell family, wasn't it?
Teaches him,
I think, yeah,
what to do in bed, basically.
That was it.
Yeah. It's a long time since I read it, but I remember that. I was like, oh my good God, that's I mean, I can only assume that Phil Rickman was basing that on, you know, fact.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure he drew on something that he'd encountered. You know, he wouldn't go into details, but I'm pretty sure he was drawing something that actually happened there.
Yeah. I mean that's kind of, I mean, to us and to our moors and our morals, that's kind of horrific in itself, isn't it? It's just that sort of darkness. That,
I think one of the interesting things about folk horror is obviously who the antagonist is, because sometimes there is no clear antagonist. Sometimes the antagonist is an entire community, which is too big for the protagonist to actually take down, and sometimes it's the landscape itself. Very occasionally, someone is summoning an old god or a demon or something similar.
We're just going to tick that little box.
Or they believe they are.
It's time.
And in somehow the ones where it's a case of, no, they believe they are, but you never see any evidence for it, is somehow worse, because you can't reason with that.
No, absolutely. It's sort of, going back a little bit, I think, as you say, that you can't reason with it and things like that, what really interests me is this idea that you get with folk horror, that it doesn't matter who you are, circumstances can make monsters out of everybody or anything. And you could be the most, you know, the most civilized, upright member of society, and yet you can become a savage, as it were. I was looking at, Frankenstein is a great example of it. Not necessarily actually because of the main story of Frankenstein, but obviously because it starts with this kind of nod towards, you know, towards Walton, who's off on his Antarctic adventure. And even though this was written before Sir John Franklin's Arctic voyage, there's kind of this echo of this society where obviously Sir John Franklin's Arctic voyage ended with the ice, with the ship getting caught up in the ice, the crew abandoning the ship, and then they all eventually died of hypothermia and starvation, but not before they had to resort to cannibalism. And that always struck me, because this was during an era as well where Britain, this colonizing power of this sort of the British Empire, went around and demonized other places, like, oh, look at them, they're savages, they eat each other, they're cannibals, and that was often, you know, a big part of this propaganda machine. And then it was this, look how we are superior, look how we are better. But Mary Shelley was kind of nodding towards this idea that actually when the environment rises, and obviously she was a romanticist, she really believed in the power of the environment. When the environment sort of comes into play, when circumstances are right, people will do whatever they have to do, and people will become superstitious. And I think you see that a lot in horror fiction, particularly when, you know, as you said, someone is trying to summon a pagan deity of some kind, and you never see any evidence of that, but people start to behave like it already exists. And something about the environment has basically meant that all of that finely created layer of society has been put to the side. All rules are gone. We are now, it's the rule of nature, and there's something primordial and terrifying and just really, God, I can't even describe it, but it's terrifying the whole way through. And I think that that's what it does, is it nods to the fact that human beings will do what they have to do to survive, no matter how much we like to say that we're civilized creatures.
Yeah, the social facade is kind of tissue thin in a lot of ways.
Yeah. It only works so long as everybody else is abiding by it, but the moment someone doesn't, it all crumbles away.
Definitely. Okay, so where else can we find folk horror? Obviously, we've mentioned crime, and we've mentioned the excellent Phil Rickman. Just in case you didn't get the memo, Madeline, you should really try out his book sometime.
Yes.
Folk songs. Folk songs are absolutely rife with folk horror.
Yay!
So everything from murder ballads to ghosts to demon summonings to warnings that get ignored to love songs. Please note, love songs in folklore tradition always end in tragedy, as opposed to songs with love in them, which are a different thing.
Yeah, it's the difference between the I love my love and love is no more and she died and oh no, I accidentally shot her, or the devil took her, and the we happen to be getting married. If it's a love song, it's going to end badly.
Definitely, it makes me think of this song. Even though it was written by, it wasn't actually an old song, it sounds like it, but on the classic folk rock album Legion Leaf by Feathered Invention, the last track on that album,
yes.
Crazy Man Michael, is the absolute epitome of a tragic, magical love story.
And then you get things like Long Lambkin, which I love that. I was introduced to that through Jules's book, and I was like, oh my god. it was the most spine-tingling it was the first really spine-tingling moment in the book. And then of course there are hands reaching through the window and all that. But it just captured my imagination, because suddenly there was that real folk horror element, and I love this tale of Long Lambkin just creeping about. What is he? Nobody knows, but he's there, and he can get through your window.
I love the fact that you went straight, you made a beeline for the folk song that I actually referenced in that book, and you were kind of like, that's the song for me, I'm going to cover that myself.
Yeah, I did. I actually did it with my choir. I arranged it for them, and I was like, we're going to sing this. They're like, what is this? And I'm like, don't ask questions, we're singing it.
Also, folk songs and folk horror can encapsulate some quite profound mythic stuff. I'm thinking particularly of the folk song King Henry by Steel I Span, which is a retelling, told many ways and many times, of the Locally Lady. If you know the Locally Lady, basically it's sovereignty, it's the land where King Henry or whoever it might be goes through all sorts of trials and all sorts of awful stuff to please this monstrous hag or ghost or whatever it might be, and eventually only by doing exactly what she asks, eventually she turns into the most beautiful woman you've ever seen, etc. But that's very much taking the ideas of folk horror and folklore and bringing in a deeper, older thread, older mythic threads, I think, really going deep. I mean, so deep and so profound in this country, or any other country, but, where the queen or the king, at their coronation, they wed the land.
Like the ballad of the Fisher King.
Yeah, yeah. And, given a ring, the queen at her coronation is given, given to her or it kept, and she gives the ring. But it's basically a symbolic marrying of the land, the goddess in the land, of sovereignty. The actual presence of sovereignty. And I think that's quite an interesting sort of way that that folklore, folk horror, it can bring in quite deep and profound mythic motifs, which I find fascinating.
Yeah.
Sorry, it that makes me think of just a small joke in Horrible Histories.
Oh,
where you just you see Queen Elizabeth I, you know, Elizabeth Tudor, and she says, "I am married to England," and there's just a little peasant in the corner goes, "Cool, how big is her bed?" But it's really stupid, but it makes me laugh.
Sorry, other places, but sorry, just to finish this little segment off, middle grade fiction seems to lend itself really well to folk horror. So there's obviously things like Susan Cooper's Oversea Under Stone,
mm-hmm.
and The Dark is Rising, and things like Alan Garner.
Mm-hmm.
Even though The Weird Stone of Brisingamen is more dark fantasy, it's got a definite folk horror element.
Yeah.
And if you move on to things like The Owl Service, I would say that's pure folk horror.
Yeah.
And yeah, you see it in sort of, it seeds itself into things. I talk about Robin Jarvis a lot because he was quite influential for me as a teenager, and he definitely draws on folk horror a lot.
Mm.
I wouldn't have known what to call it at the time, but looking back, there's very strong folk horror elements in what he writes as well. And I seem to see more of it popping up in middle grade fiction now. So, you know, old gods and, you know, strange beasts and nature, and in young adult fiction as well to a certain extent, whereby there's a wood where strange things happen, or there's a hill where strange things happen, and those things normally reflective of something that's not quite right in the teenage protagonist's life as well.
Yeah, it is amazing actually how much it is in middle grade. It's just they're like, right, they've gotten to a certain age, time to introduce them to the horror of the environment. Come along, children. And they love it.
I think folk horror also is, well, at least in the 70s, I'm probably
wrong, yeah.
But it was quite prevalent in children's TV. I mean, I'm thinking of two particular things. One, Bagpuss. I think Bagpuss definitely has elements of, I mean, yeah, maybe leave out the horror, but it's definitely eerie, I find. I think Bagpuss is amazing, but there's definitely an eeriness and a sort of a certain kind of wistful eeriness to it, and it toys come alive. I mean, you know, that's dolls, you know, well, dolls are scary, aren't they? Like, dolls coming alive is scary.
Definitely.
But, definitely. Yeah,
I love that Jules is straight away in there. Sorry, I also laugh,
but, yep,
because
dolls are creepy.
The whole.
Yeah, I definitely put Bagpuss in there, but the other one, which I found quite scary, was the old Wurzel Gummer.
Yeah. Oh my god, I grew up watching that, and I was fascinated, and I couldn't stop watching it. My sister, who was a year younger than me, was absolutely terrified of Wurzel Gummidge, and he was scary. He never did anything. Yeah. And, you know, Aunt Sally as well. The fact that there's this big life-size wooden doll coming to life, for a start, that's not great.
Mackenzie Crook has done, was like with the new, I don't know if you've seen the new Rose of Gummidge, which was on Last Christmas, which was absolutely, it's one of the most magical, beautiful things. But he's a very different character to
yeah,
the old John
Perkins.
Yeah,
I didn't see that.
It's brilliant. And it's, you know, it falls within this remit, even though, you know, it's not horrific. There are moments that are a little bit freaky, but funny and beautiful and witty. But music probably one pound, but the old world of Gummidge, where, you know, taking his head off, you know, turning up heads and selection of heads, it was, I found, really, really creepy. But I think one of the creepiest things was the fact he wasn't a sympathetic character. He wasn't horrible. He didn't do evil things, but he wasn't nice. And so he kind of leaves you that classic feeling of folk horror where you're the outside, you're not quite sure what's going on. You're never quite sure what he was going to do. And I found that really quite disconcerting.
he wasn't understandable for either a child or I think most adults probably looked at the Wurzel Gummidge and went, oh, you know, it's something silly for kids, you know. But for children, it was kind of like you were constantly trying to reason why he was doing the things he did.
He wasn't safe. He wasn't a safe cat.
No, he wasn't. Okay, we're coming towards the end. So let's... Okay, everyone gets two of their favourite folk horror moments. So it doesn't have to be an entire film or a book. It can just be something you really liked from one.
Okay. Why don't we all say one and then we'll go around. So Jules, why don't you start us off?
Okay. Favourite folk horror moments. Actually, probably the end of The Owl Service. Because I don't know how familiar you are with the story, Madeline, but it basically, it's a retelling of, you know, the Tengedo of Arianrhod with Blood of Earth.
Yeah.
And you have this young girl, Alison, who has kind of got caught up in the story along with the two boys who were also there that summer. And it's kind of an exploration of a teenage love triangle and yet not. It's incredibly eerie. There's a part towards the end where, you know, she's been taking the flower patterns off these plates and turning them into owls.
Mm-hmm.
And it's kind of, there's some sort of transformation going on, which is never completely elucidated for the reader.
Mm.
And you get the feeling that Alison herself is becoming something predatory. Yeah. And they manage to stop it at the end, just by one of the characters saying, you know, you're flowers, you're not owls, you silly girl, kind of thing.
Yeah.
And it kind of breaks it enough. But it was such a great, I suppose, climax moment where you had this subtle low pressure going all the way through the book.
Mm.
And, you know, hints of this legend coming through.
That's terrifying. That's really scary. Okay. Alright, so I have already mentioned it, but I've got to admit that one of the great sort of folk horror moments for me was actually in I Belong to the Earth. And No, it's true. It's genuinely true. And it was the inclusion of the song of Long Lankin. And the way that the song was introduced and the fact that you at this point knew that there was something on the moor, it just transformed the whole narrative, which up until that point had been very contemporary. And then suddenly it was like we were really, I say very contemporary, apart from, you know, the ghosts that were taking us back in time. But it really solidified that very folk horror-esque idea that maybe the thing on the moor, maybe the things, the ghosts, they were even older than they thought they were, that there was something ancient, very primordial, that was just lurking. And it was so deliciously scary.
I need to read that book. I haven't read it.
No, that's fine.
Well, one I would mention, I mean, this is a whole subject in itself, but the H.P. Lovecraft story, The Gummidge Horror, which is a kind of a strange amalgam of kind of cosmic horror and folk horror, but it definitely got the folk horror element to it, and that moment you get as you're reading it, Lovecraft is notoriously, you know, mentioned sex or didn't really, you know, have anything to do with that kind of thing. But you definitely, in that book, you definitely, there's a moment you realise that what kind of the incestuous aspects of it. I'm being a bit vague, but I don't want to spoil it because I haven't read it, but I would say the gradually growing sense of horror that the Dunwich horror is. I think there's more than just the titular horror that they have to deal with. I think there's an awful lot of horror in that book, which comes from the purely human.
Yeah, definitely. I suppose I could kind of, you know, I could name probably half a dozen from sort of Phil Rickman's books, but we are back to Phil Rickman. He is the master. I'm actually going to mention something from Robin Jarvis's The Whitby Child, which is the third book in the Whitby Witches, and it's not necessarily a horror kind of moment, but I don't know if you have heard of the Horngarth or the Pennygarth, which is a Yorkshire tradition, and it's sort of very specific to the Whitby area,
mm-hmm.
Whereby every year they make a, you know, a three-panel fence out of sort of its woven strips of birch and hazel, mm-hmm. I think, and you just basically end up with this kind of wicker fence affair, and they set it up on the beach in Whitby, and it has to withstand three waves. So when the sea starts coming in, the Horngarth has to stand up against three waves. If the waves ever take it down before the third wave, then the sea is supposed to come in, flood Whitby, and take it into the sea. It was all part, and the way he's woven it in is it was all part of some deal made by the original inhabitants of Whitby and the Lords of the Deep and Dark, so the three gods who live under the sea.
Hmm.
And that always struck me as sort of deliciously chilling, because if you start thinking about the implications of the sea just coming in and not going out again. and it's all predicated on this fragile fence that's only designed to literally hold together for sort of three waves coming in.
Mm.
So you're pitting something very fragile against something that is almost all powerful by comparison.
Yeah, okay, yeah, I can definitely see that. okay, so probably the next one for me. Again, I'm going to be really boring. I think it's probably because there have just been so many sort of moments of folk horror. Not going to lie, my favourite moments of folk horror have actually been from the stories that Jules and my partner have brought from Ireland. And also some of the stories that I've been told about from where I'm from in France and things like that. There are some great little tales. But in terms of books, I am going to mention The Woman in Black, because, as I said, it had such a profound effect on me when I first saw the play and then rereading the book, because there was that sense of it just being unstoppable. And the woman cannot be reasoned with. And there is a moment where Kipps is out on the moorland, and the sea mist has come in and he's alone. And he can hear the ghosts, he can hear these cries and these screams. And suddenly he's not just separated from, you know, civilization. He's separated from the human world entirely. He's now in the mists of time, where everything is happening all at once, where life and death have tangled together, and he is totally powerless against it. And I just, for me, that gets me every time. It's terrifying.
Well, my mind immediately goes when I think of horror. Various aspects to the Mabinogi. You already mentioned, but I mean, there's so many bits. I can't remember everyone's name, but one bit that always strikes me is just, I can't remember who it is who's chasing her. Who's chasing Rhiannon on her horse? I mean, she can never catch up. However much he tries, she's just trotting, and he's riding hard. Can never catch up with her, and it's just that.
Oh, yes.
It's just that otherness. The otherness. There's something about the Mabinogi which, it's just such a profoundly strange. You know, I mean, I know it is Welsh, but it comes from a time before there was Wales, really, isn't it? It comes from a time.
Yeah.
I mean, maybe I don't know if I'm treading on any toes when I say this. I don't think there's aliens and against Wales, but. It's such an ancient. It's when it was it Clydain, when the whole country was basically Welsh. Yeah. We're all Welsh once. Yeah. And
sorry, the way you say that, it was just that, well, at one time, we were all Welsh once. Like, we've gotten over it now, fortunately. But,
I don't know. That's one part of many strange and wonderful aspects of the Magnolia, which always just sticks in my mind as an eerie kind of moment. Just, you're dealing with an ancient magic and an ancientness and a strangeness which has been captured sort of fragmentarily in the Magnolia of a time long before anyone remembers, when there were heroes and there were gods and there were huge events happening which we forgot, it's all lost in prehistory. And I find that
definitely. Mm. One of the things that I sort of like about the Mabinogion is that you don't have to go very far. I mean, I lived in Wales for 4 years. You don't have to go very far in Wales to find somebody who can say, oh, I can trace my ancestors back to this person, to this person, to this family, to this, the Ap Llewellyns, and then further back still. And it's kind of like, who were found on this branch of the Mabinogi? And it's really fascinating how many Welsh people who genuinely can, or, you know, do suggest that. And with the Mabinogion, it's like none of those tales have what we would consider a satisfying ending in terms of it ended happily, or at least, you know, everyone got their just desserts. Usually terrible things happen to everybody in those stories.
Yeah, it kind of feels like because they're real, you know, they don't meet me in the way that perhaps a fiction tale might, because you get this feeling that there's something, the truth in this, which makes it uncomfortable, and the ending sort of messy. I like that.
Yeah, definitely. Okay, well, before we go on to our Dissecting Dragons recommendation for this week, we have a bonus treat for you, and Phil is going to read us another poem.
Okay, yes, thank you. This one is a bit longer than the last one. This is called The Night Before Samhain. 'Twas the night before Samhain, and all through the stead many creatures were stirring, and all of them dead. Mouse skulls were nailed to the roof beam with care to ward against the squash head who soon would be there. The night children cowered and shivered with fear, for they knew that old pumpkin face soon would loom near. Each knew, as they harked to the thundering rain, that he would be hungered for bone and for brain. Then out came the moon as the cloud shrank away. It lit up the stead near as bright as the day. A young girl, with skin all as pale as death, went to the doorway with nary a breath. She looked out at the shadows, a seek with her eyes. Then she hearkened the tell-tale buzzing of flies that foretell his coming, the nightmare made flesh, seeking for meat better rotten than fresh. Then there he was, in all his fell glory, swinging his cleaver all crusted and gory, singing, come out, for you are my feast. I'll devour you all, from the most to the least. Hark to the song I sing, hark to my rhyme, for I am old pumpkin face, this is my time. I swear by the seeds all arot in my head, that I am the eater, and I eat the dead. Then out from the gloom his ghouls came a-dancing, screeching and hooting and hopping and prancing. They circled the stead, running faster and faster, eager to scare out the dead for their master. And as blood gasps poured out from the evernight wood, I think you'll agree things were not looking good. The girl made for Mother, then made a decision. She would handle this fix with a measured precision. She looked to the skulls, nailed high upon the beam. with luck they would hold whilst she worked on her scheme. She shut the stead door and she fastened it tightly, and lit up a candle that shone warm and brightly. The night children gathered to hear what she said, the plan that was hatched in the night by the dead. There's much to do, so we'll work as a coven. Fetch me the wished hat and light up the oven. Don't bring me the beret, the cap or the bonnet. Fetch me the one with the stars and moons on it. We'll work as a coven, so fetch 13 chairs and the old blackened cauldron from under the stairs. They kindled the oven, they circled the chairs, they dragged the old cauldron from under the stairs. And now, said Camilla from under the hat, we'll summon the help of a singular cat. But then from outside came a terrible sound that shuddered the stead and the woods and the ground. Old Pumpkin Face, not used to being denied, was roaring his rage as it pricked at his pride. The swash head leapt up to land high upon the roof, where he stamped at the slates with a great slimy hoof. I swear by the seeds all a-rot in my head, you shall let me in. 'Tis time I was fed. Ignore him, Fenella cried. Pay him no heed. If we work together, then we shall succeed. Let him bluster up there. Let him slobber and slaver. Down here we'll get on with the abracadabra. She took up a wand made of alder and oak, bade them join hands. Then the night child spoke. Cougavad, Cougavad, monarch of night, we beg that you help us and answer our plight. Cougavad, Cougavad, pause in your prowling, and come to us spitting and hissing and yowling. Come to us fierce, approach us ferocious, the foe you're to face is surpassing atrocious. Grimalkin Rex, we crave your assistance, and do please excuse our unseemly persistence. Out from the cauldron the cat came a-swerving. He moved in a manner sublime yet unnerving. Great king, said Fenella, we must beware, for the lord of the damned is a caper out there. Fear not, he replied as he reached the stead door. This battle is old, girl. We fought it before. 'Tis the evening of winter. The holly kings rule, and the ripe shall be spoiled ere the coming of you. The lord of the damned, he's most certainly not. Up there, my girl, is old Jack a-rot. He never remembers. Each year 'tis the same, for his rotten old head can't conceive of the game. A wisp of the autumn, the holly king's fool, destined to die by the breaking of Yule. Now think at it, girl. The pumpkin, the hat, the wand and the cauldron, the rather fine cat. You are the winter's witch, he a poor brute, made of hairy string, sticks and an old rotting fruit. You are the witch, and this is the season, and I am the king of the cats for good reason. And ask yourself this, if you still don't believe, what happens to pumpkins on All Hallows Eve?
Brilliant. Oh, no, I wanted to applaud then.
Thank you so much for sharing that. Both of those poems were just brilliant. And I'm sure that as we continue our run-up to sort of Halloween, that our listeners will very much have appreciated that. So thank you.
Well, you're most welcome. And can I just do a quick plug? I haven't quite sorted it out, all the ins and outs yet, but on Halloween itself, probably early evening, I am planning to do a Zoom kind of thing where I'll be reading those two and a number of other poems, some considerably darker, from the darker end of my poem book, for Halloween, a few things, probably an hour or so. That will be on Facebook.
Oh, brilliant.
Hopefully, within the week. So, if anyone fancies
Yeah. If you give
coming
us,
along
if
and
you, if you give us the details, we'll retweet it. For you.
Okay.
As well.
Once I've got them, I'll let you know.
Fantastic.
Excellent. Thank you very much.
And thank you very much for being a guest on this episode about folk horror.
You're most welcome. Thank you for having me.
It's been brilliant. Before we go, it is time for our Dissecting Dragons recommendation of the week. And Jules, I believe that you've got one for us.
I have. Last year I recommended The Haunting of Hill House, the Netflix adaptation, which is amazing. And the same people have created a series called The Haunting of Bly Manor. Obviously, this isn't folk horror. This is back more into the ghost story side of things. But it was really, really good. It's very character-driven. It's quite spooky. And like all the best ghost stories, it is about the human problems. And they're kind of looking at all the different characters, each having their own arc. And the resolution is just superb, I think. Plus, there's a very, very cute sapphic love story in there as well.
Aww.
it's really, really good. I think our listeners will definitely enjoy that one.
Fantastic. Okay. For now, we'll say thanks very much for tuning in. Do be sure to leave us comments telling us what your favourite folk horrors are. Do you agree with the ones that we've talked about? Can you think of any others? Let us know. And remember, you can get in contact via Twitter or Facebook, both for the Dissecting Dragons page or individually as authors. For now, we'll say thanks very much for listening and we'll catch you guys next week.
Yeah, thanks and goodbye.
Bye.
Bye.
You've been listening to Dissecting Dragons, the speculative fiction podcast. You can follow our podcast at podbean.com or from iTunes. For more information, visit our Facebook page at www.facebook.com/dissectingreaders or check out our author websites at jaironside.com and madelinevaughan.com. Please note that no dragons were harmed during the making of this podcast.